Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
What Bean's financial documents show is that even though this is a nonprofit organization, it was actually making huge profits during this time.
An investigation finds Bean's Cafe made millions managing Anchorage's pandemic homeless shelter. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, heavy winter snow and ice jams caused flooding and damage to homes.
There's at least one that was carried all the way away, and there were others that were moved and that are beyond repair.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree-seeking students the opportunity to receive donor-funded scholarships, grants, and other financial aid. Apply for admission to be automatically considered for most scholarships. Complete financial aid applications by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The state Senate failed to pass a budget today, leaving a narrow window of time for a last-minute budget deal before the end of the regular session tomorrow evening. The House and Senate are hoping to avoid a special session, but have been split over the size of the permanent fund dividend and whether to dip into state savings. Republican-led House leaders have proposed a $2,700 PFD that would require a large draw from state savings. The bipartisan majority Senate has favored a more modest $1,300 PFD that doesn't require dipping into savings with current oil revenue projections. State Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says the PFD has been the main topic of discussions.
Yeah, I think we want as big a dividend as possible. The question is, how do you pay for it?
Senate President Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak, says the leaders of both chambers hope to meet again tonight to come up with a deal so that the Senate can pass the budget to the House tomorrow.
We're hoping to hear from the House between now and tomorrow's meeting, and hoping we find a compromise that we can all live with.
This afternoon, the Senate adjourned without voting on a budget. With only a day left in the session, agreeing on a budget through a conference committee is no longer an option. The only way the legislature can pass a bill by Wednesday night to fund the government is if the House votes to approve the Senate's budget. If the chambers come up with a deal and the Senate advances it, the House could approve the bill tomorrow in what's known as concurrence. The House and Senate have not concurred on a budget since 1982. If a deal fails, Governor Mike Dunleavy could call the legislature into a special session. It's unclear when that would happen and how many days it would last. A new joint investigation by Alaska Public Media and APM Reports has found that an Anchorage nonprofit organization made nearly $10 million in profits while it was running the city's pandemic homeless shelter. The money came from a generous city contract funded by federal taxpayers. Bean's Cafe also billed the city hundreds of thousands of dollars for services the city says were never provided. And more than a year after Bean's lost its contract to run the shelter at the Sullivan Arena, the billing dispute remains unresolved. Here to discuss this is Nat Herz. He reported the story with our partners at APM Reports. Thanks for joining us, Nat.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
So, Nat, how did Bean's Cafe end up making so much profit from running the homeless shelter at the Sullivan Arena?
So, Bean's opened Anchorage's massive pandemic shelter at the Sullivan Hockey Arena at the beginning of the pandemic. They needed more space to house people experiencing homelessness so the virus didn't just like rip through these smaller existing shelters that the city had. Bean's got the contract to manage the shelter without going through a competitive bidding process because the coronavirus had already popped up. The city needed to move fast and Bean's already had a contract to run a smaller homeless shelter. But what we discovered was that when the city opened the new larger shelter, the cost also went way, way up. The maximum number of guests Bean's was serving at Sullivan went up by about 3 times from the smaller shelter they'd operated before, but the amount they were getting paid went up more than 10 times to as much as $800,000 a month. Over a year and a half of operating the shelter, That added up to more than $13 million. And what Bean's financial documents show is that even though this is a nonprofit organization, it was actually making huge profits during this time, roughly $9.8 million.
Well, did city employees know about this?
So at the time, city employees obviously didn't have one of the benefits that we had 3 years later of looking at Bean's financial records. But what's interesting is that the city employee who was responsible for overseeing Bean's contract eventually came to the conclusion that the city was not getting a good deal. And also that Bean's was sometimes billing for services it wasn't actually providing. This all started when the employee, her name is Sean Hayes, noticed that the number of people that the city was being billed to host at the shelter wasn't falling in the spring when you'd expect more folks in the shelter to start camping outside. So Hayes actually went over to the shelter early one morning and started counting up the number of people there. And she was surprised to find that many of the beds were empty. Beans explained this by saying that it counted guests over a 24-hour period instead of a single point in time. Like, as long as someone checked in once a day, Beans still got paid. Under the contract, folks didn't actually have to sleep at the Sullivan shelter. But Hayes ended up flagging a number of other problems with Beans' billing records and the way it was handling the contract, things like data reporting, documentation of 911 calls, and most importantly, charges for security workers. Hayes and other city employees found that Beans was charging the city for security staffing that wasn't actually being provided. The exact amount of that is in dispute, but Beans acknowledged that this happened and that these unstaffed shifts were worth at least $100,000. The city ended up withholding about $800,000 in money Beans said it was owed at one point while the two sides were negotiating.
Wow. So Hayes alleges that Beans has all these problems. How did this all end up playing out?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. It's been 2 years since Hayes first did this headcount and noticed some of these problems at the Sullivan shelter. But Mayor Dave Bronson's administration says the dispute over Bean's billing still hasn't been settled. And they say they're working on it, but they won't say what form those discussions are taking. And as of a few weeks ago, the assistant municipal attorney, the city lawyer assigned to the case, still hadn't exchanged emails with Bean's lawyers in nearly a year, according to emails we got through a public records request. Bean's took a really aggressive tack and they fought Hayes's findings. Here's how she put it.
Like, if the city came to me and said, hey, like, we have these concerns, like, I would have came back to my office and have been like pulling up records and you know what I mean? And
yes.
And if I, you know, and if there was, I'd say, oh gosh, we overbilled you. How much do we owe you? You know what I mean? And we did not get that. We did not get that at all.
At one point, Beans even threatened to file a lawsuit to ensure that it got paid. But now the organization says it isn't seeking any more money from the city.
And so what happened to Hayes?
Hayes actually was fired by Bronson, the mayor. This came later on after the billing dispute started and after Beans lost its contract to run the Sullivan shelter. And it looks like this connects to that letter that former municipal manager Amy Demboski's lawyer released earlier this year.
This is the one that alleges that the mayor and his administration did all these illegal and unethical things, right?
Right. So after Hayes raises all these concerns about Beans and its billing practices, she pushes the put the contract up to competitive bid. And she says that right before the city awarded the new contract for the Sullivan shelter, she ran into the mayor's top homelessness advisor, John Morris, in City Hall. And she says Morris made it clear he wanted the city to keep Beans Cafe in charge of the shelter. The panel that Hayes sat on gave the contract to the other bidder anyway. That was a for-profit company called 99 Plus One. A month or so later, the mayor fires her. The letter from Demboski's attorney doesn't name Hayes, but there was a reference in it to a, quote, improper retaliatory termination. And Hayes says she's sure that the letter is talking about her.
What do Morris and the mayor say about this?
Well, the mayor isn't saying anything, but Morris disputes Hayes and Demboski's accounts. He says he wanted the city to keep working with Beans, but that was for stability's sake. He was worried that switching operators at the Sullivan could lead to chaos.
And what about Beans Cafe? What do they say about the nearly $10 million in profits they made?
Well, first of all, both Beans and city officials who worked on drafting this contract said that Beans really had to take on a ton of risk in running the Sullivan shelter. when they signed this deal, nobody knew how this was all going to go during the pandemic. Beans had to quadruple the number of its employees in a month and a half. They also said, look, we're a nonprofit. Lisa Sauter, the chief executive of Beans, is paid $123,000 a year. Her salary didn't go up during the years we were looking at. The profits that they made, they said, were plowed into this huge new warehouse and commercial kitchen that Beans just opened that prepares free meals for Anchorage residents in need.
Well, you can read the full story from Nat and our partners at American Public Media at alaskapublic.org. Nat, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unhoused Anchorage residents navigate an uncertain future.
For example, you can't camp in parks. Is the administration going to enforce that provision, and are they going to abate people out of parks?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Congresswoman Mary Peltola's mother has died. Lizanne Williams was originally from the Kuskokwim Delta village of Queethluck. She died Friday, according to announcements Peltola made on Twitter. No details were provided. Williams was married to Bethel City manager Peter Williams. He announced his retirement last month, saying it would be better for he and his wife to live in Anchorage, in part for health reasons. In an interview with KYUK, he gave his wife's age as 76. The congresswoman is in Alaska this week. Peltola plans to be in her hometown of Bethel on Wednesday at an event with First Lady Jill Biden and Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. The focus of the trip is on the expansion of broadband internet made possible by the 2021 infrastructure bill. Communities across Interior and Southwest Alaska are dealing with severe flooding. National Weather Service hydrologist Dave Struble says the greatest area of concern on the lower Kuskokwim River lies near Kalskag. Residents from there to Bethel at the river's mouth can expect flooding in the next day or so. Struble says this season's flooding is a result of heavy winter snowfall across the state.
That, associated with the cool spring, is causing a chain reaction, so to speak, of a lot of snow and all of a sudden it all melting at once.
According to Struble, ice jam concerns on the Kuskokwim should subside in several days, followed by the Yukon in 7 to 10 days. In Glen Allen, hit by heavy snowmelt from local creeks that flooded buildings, schools were closed for a second day today, and residents have been asked to limit water usage while the local utility is setting up porta-potties around the community. The State Transportation Department said there was water over a portion of the Glen Highway yesterday, but it remained open. In the upper Yukon River village of Circle, recovery from weekend flooding continues. Kyle Wright with the Tanana Chiefs Conference says the ice and water damage to homes is in line with historic breakup floods that hit Eagle in 2009 and Galena in 2013.
There's at least one that was carried all the way away, and there were others that were moved and that are beyond repair.
Wright says Circle has also seen extensive damage to key infrastructure, including flooding at its power plant. That means the community has a full tank of fresh water, but no power for its pumps. Fort Yukon, also on the Yukon, saw some flooding Sunday, according to National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum.
We had reports of water over roads and some structures and homes getting water in them.
Plum says villages farther downriver are now facing the same backup from a 40-mile run of ice. The villages of Tanana, Rampart, and Minto were among those under a flood watch through Wednesday night. Both chambers of the Alaska Legislature unanimously passed a bill that requires the State Department of Corrections to issue identification to all people leaving prisons and jails. Currently, up to 15% of people leaving correctional facilities in Alaska don't have IDs. That presents a big challenge for people trying to reintegrate in society, says bill sponsor Senator Rob Myers, a Fairbanks Republican.
How do we make sure they have access to housing, to employment, to picking up prescriptions, all the usual things that we need in order to be, regular members of society? Well, you got to have an ID.
The bill passed the House Saturday. The Department of Corrections says the legislation will not cost anything since it already has equipment to print IDs. The cards do not work as driver's licenses or to buy alcohol, but Myers says otherwise they have the same legal status as IDs issued by the DMV. Unsanctioned but generally tolerated encampments in public spaces around Anchorage have been growing since the city's biggest shelter scaled down and things warmed up outside. As policymakers try to establish more housing, more temporary shelter, and consider officially sanctioning some camping sites, people already living outdoors are in limbo. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Brianna Witzke has been frequenting Anchorage Assembly meetings lately, where she confronts officials with some of the most immediate issues affecting people experiencing homelessness. Here's a bit of her testimony from the last one.
Transgender, 13 years. We have a massive homeless problem. You guys are going through the red tape bit by bit. And I'm here to tell you, I'm from the street, I am in the street, I am jobless, I am homeless, and I am this way because I'm here to help you guys.
Technically, she isn't homeless right now. She says she recently got a grant that covers rent for a place in Chugiak, but lately she's been living out of a van and tent in a vacant lot next to Cuddy Family Midtown Park. Dozens more tents are pitched in and around the immediate area. The 43-year-old sees herself as a guide for people who are homeless. Right now, she's trying to quickly build a more secure, temporary space here for people to live that she envisions looking a lot like a typical drive-up campground. But Witzke is operating in a big gray area. More and more people are illegally camping in Anchorage after shelter capacity was cut and temperatures rise. But under a federal court ruling, authorities generally can't enforce no camping laws when low barrier shelter spaces are full, which they are. Witzke and hundreds of other people living out of cars and tents in Anchorage don't really know what will or won't be tolerated. For example, on the gravel footprint where a new National Archives building was once planned, Witzke caught some heat recently. She was stacking shipping pallets to make three-sided stalls for tent sites.
All right, so if I stagger so across, I can make them stretch further. And what I can do is if I take, for a prime example, approximately 3.5 feet tall.
A municipal parks employee pulls up in a pickup truck.
This isn't happening with the pallets, so... No okay. Pallet houses, no concrete slabs.
Your name is? Ma'am, your name is? Have a good day, bye!
Witzke was not deterred. Later that day, she brainstormed ideas about what legalized camping should look like with a room full of officials and nonprofit leaders. It's a task force spearheaded by Assemblymember Felix Rivera. Rivera says there is wiggle room, legally speaking, to clear camps under certain conditions.
For example, you can't camp in parks. And so is the administration going to enforce that provision, and are they going to abate people out of parks? Those are the questions that I'm asking the administration to really be public about. What is their policy going to be this summer? Because I don't know.
Rivera says the campers and community at large need clarity.
But until then, it's sort of like a free-for-all.
For now, the plan is to meet the campers where they are. Teams from Anchorage Parks and Recreation are visiting known sites twice a week to clean up trash. Several service organizations and volunteers are also regularly providing food, basic medical care, and maintaining ties to social services and housing waitlists. Witzke is pushing ahead with her campground and says she's even gotten gifts from individuals in the community to help cover her tab at Home Depot. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
The federal government has agreed to buy almost $120 million in Alaska sockeye salmon and groundfish products. It's a win for the state's marketing branch, which had some help from Alaska's congressional delegation. And as KDLG's Izzy Ross reports, people in the industry say it's good news just ahead of the next fishing season.
Bristol Bay fishermen harvested a record-breaking 60 million sockeye last summer. That flooded the market with a surplus of salmon. And earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture agreed to help with that glut by purchasing almost $120 million of canned and filleted sockeye and ground fish. But that's not going to clear out the storehouses and shelves.
As far as, you know, fixing the problem of such a, you know, a giant harvest from last year, it's not going to fix anything, but it's certainly going to help in a big way, in a really big way.
Bruce Schachtler works with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. He says they asked the USDA to buy Alaska seafood for their food assistance programs last fall, when they knew there would be a surplus.
It kind of got stalled for whatever reason, so we asked the three members of our congressional delegation to provide some encouragement to hurry this along, and that was clearly successful.
Alaska's congressional delegation submitted a joint letter to the USDA at the end of March, asking the department to commit to buying millions of pounds of sockeye and pollock. That pressure helped cut through the competition, Schachtler says, since there's only so many federal dollars to go around.
The folks up in the Northeast Atlantic, they want to sell fish, and they do. And the catfish guys and the Gulf shrimp guys and the West Coast groundfish people. And then you're also competing with those same dollars with walnuts, pistachios, and fruits and vegetables.
It took 8 months for the USDA to agree to make the purchase, and Schachtler doesn't know how long it will take to actually distribute the fish.
There's a lot of things that need to happen now. They got to decide where they're going to ship it, how much they're going to ship, when they're going to ship. Is it going to be to Omaha in October? Is it going to be Los Angeles in June?
Still, he says the timing of the announcement is encouraging, as the Copper River sockeye fishery kicks off, putting fresh fish on the market.
So this is going to provide some relief. It's going to move some product.
That just in time for the summer fishing season. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Could you imitate a loon calling its mate? How about an eagle or a chickadee? Well, maybe you should have been at Homer's annual bird calling competition. It's a fan favorite of the annual Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival that includes 4 days of guided tours, presentations, and family activities for birding enthusiasts. The competition featured locals and visitors of all ages showcasing their favorite bird calls, beautiful, mysterious, and wacky alike. KBBI's Corinne Smith has the story.
5-year-old Cassidy Almendinger confidently walks to the mic on a makeshift outdoor stage. She's the first contestant of Homer's annual bird calling competition.
First, I am going to be doing the See and Hear Crew.
Almendinger says she learned that one from her grandmother. And it's a special spring call for many Homerites, as the striking gold and gray cranes return to mate on the shores of Kachemak Bay.
Next, I am going to be doing chickadee. Chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee, chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
A large crowd is gathered outside the Homer Brewing Company for the competition. Some have just come from birding workshops or kayak trips as part of the 4-day Shorebird Festival. 17-year-old Marina Steffi steps up with another distinct and familiar call. The bird calling competition draws contestants of all ages. Some have bird-themed t-shirts and binoculars still hanging around their necks. 4 judges are seated at a table to the front, all decked out in bright feather boas.
I haven't practiced since coffee this morning. Bald eagle. Yes.
Some bird calls are serious and some are funny. Some are easily identified while others leave the crowd guessing.
Hello everyone, I'm gonna be doing a very elusive bird call that I've never seen myself and you probably haven't either. It's the wet-billed blue-winged red belly. Wonderful. Do we have guesses?
Brown sparrow. I don't know the answer.
That was a golden crowned sparrow, known for its distinct three-note trill. One contestant introduces himself as Mr. Oyster Catcher and wears red leggings and a black feather boa with a bright orange beak glued to a hat.
I didn't plan to participate, but when you show up to a bird calling contest dressed up as a bird, people are going to have expectations. So here's my best Oyster Catcher impression.
After a long and careful deliberation, the judges announced the winners. Penny Gage of Anchorage took home one of the top prizes for her eagle call.
I practiced that call growing up in Sitka, working on a tour boat in the summer, and I'm really glad to see it come into use today. And I love the Shorebird Festival. I love migratory birds and really happy to be here.
One of the judges is Cindy Ma, a bird guide and owner of Seldovia Nature Tours. She's holding pages of notes on the contestants.
Like everybody has a star. And then look at how many we circled. Yeah, it was all so good. We kept saying, how are we gonna do this?
17-year-old Marina Steffi, who did the memorable seagull call, was also a prize winner.
Well, I did the gray jay, I did the raven, and then I did a seagull, which is a pretty easy one. And then I did a magpie.
She says she grew up birding on her grandparents' property in Kenai. This is her first bird calling competition, and she says she hopes to learn more bird calls and compete again.
I'm into a lot of birds, because I had chickens growing up, and right now I just have a turkey. And I just love birds like the robins and the chickadees. I even rescue birds every now and then.
As a light rain starts to fall, the crowd disperses, some heading to more festival events. Others turn in for the night, preparing for more early morning birding the next day, excited to experience the birds of Kachemak Bay. In Homer, I'm Corinne Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz, Chris Clint and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lex Trinan in Juneau, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Corinne Smith in Homer. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.